If you only listen to our podcasts, I want to encourage you to visit unfetteredmind.org. Here you'll find, free of charge, dozens of original articles and contemporary translations of Buddhist texts and prayers. If you find these helpful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can continue to expand the website and support your practice. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind, Awakening from Belief, Part 6.
Well, there are a few people still to come, so why don't we take some time and take up any questions you have about your practice.
I was remembering what Thich Nhat Hanh said when he was asked why the Vietnamese War happened to Vietnam. And he said, it didn't just happen to Vietnam, it happened to all of us. And I guess that was based on the Mexican independence. So I was also thinking about the Iraq War, and that's been brought up here a couple of times. And that's a sense I have about that too, that it happened to all of us. And that we're all, I mean, Thich Nhat Hanh said, not only did it happen to all of us, Vietnamese War, but we're all responsible in some very basic sense, based on the notion. So it seems to me that the Iraq War and a lot of other social ills or issues also fit in that category.
Andrew.
What category is that? I couldn't hear you. Drop your voice.
Interdependence, that we're all in some way a participant in anything that happens, especially as the world turns. And it sort of happens to all of us, and we're sort of responsible for it all. This is just following up on a comment by Thich Nhat Hanh.
I think we have to be very careful how we use words. A few years ago, I went to a local bookstore because there was a person giving a talk on a book he'd written about torturers. And he'd interviewed five groups of torturers. One was the members of the Israeli army. Another was a certain unit in the Chicago police force. Third was something in Central America. Can't remember what the other two were. It was a disturbing evening. And two things that I recall most clearly from it was that in all cases, the torturers were very ordinary people. And the second is that the torturers felt they had license to do what they were doing. In fact, not only license, they had been tacitly asked by the society to do what they were doing. Because every society has a class of people that they don't care what happens to. Well, I mean, that's maybe too broad a statement, but when you look closely at most societies, you can discover in India it's the untouchables. We certainly have it in our society. And certainly in English society and French society. So if you come up with a counterexample, fine. But it's pretty widespread. Now, there may be a social need for some dynamic in the structure of societies about that, but I haven't studied that or looked into it. In any event, now, I have difficulty with the use of the word responsibility in the way that you're saying Thich Nhat Hanh uses it. Yeah.
I think Thich Nhat Hanh is very good in that thing.
Yeah.
And the way that word is used is the way I interpret it.
Okay.
Which is me interpreting it. But that is what he said, so however one wants
yeah. Well, I know what he's pointing to. But as I say, I think we have to be very careful what words we actually do use. Because it's very easy to create problems that don't exist through the misuse of language. I was discussing this at breakfast with Newcomb and Baring, actually. The use of the war metaphor. The use of the war metaphor. Okay. Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty. Okay, who's the enemy? Who's the enemy in the war on poverty? Exactly. That's what you get to. And that's why it's inappropriate as used. And I feel something about the use of the word responsibility, similar in the use of the word responsibility here, as it's used in normal English. Now, what I think Thich Nhat Hanh may be pointing to is that each of us have the same tendencies within us. And it is very much a responsibility in our practice to identify and dismantle the reactive patterns that give rise to the same form of discrimination, inconsideration, even hatred and rejection. And if you look at the Bodhisattva vow, and the Bodhisattva vow of aspiration, there are two states of mind which violate it. One is despair, and the other is rejecting a sentient being. Despair is, I can't do this. And the reason that that's regarded as a violation of the of aspiration bodhicitta, of the aspiration to wake up, is because when you say, I can't do this, you're denying your own spiritual potential. Okay? And you're denying what you actually are. And in rejecting a sentient being, and the definition of this is, of either of these two states, is that you hold these for more than 2 hours, which is the length of time it takes for them to become fixed, I mean, approximately. Then you have to renew the vow. Nice thing about bodhisattva, those attitudes. And rejecting a sentient being is when somebody does something and you say to yourself, I will never help that person again. Now, if you hold that attitude for more than 2 hours, you've violated the bodhisattva vow. So these are very, and this is straight traditional classical Buddhism, but you can see within those ethical principles there's instruction that would prevent us from harboring any of the attitudes that make war and torture and those kinds of things possible. And I think, yes, we have that kind of responsibility in our practice. And I think that's what Thich Nhat Hanh is pointing to. Okay, other questions? Yes?
Stems from yesterday, from a question about the practice of shamatha leading to insight as different from leading to compassion. And to my experience, the two seem so intertwined. I was unable to catch where they separated and how they are not almost one and the same.
Compassion and insight? Oh, they're quite different. They're quite different.
But don't they arise almost co-emergently?
That's a big word. Where'd you get that one? Where's my dictionary? Ah, that's the Lenchi Chepiesha, I guess. Okay. How much do you want on this?
I'm asking the question because it's...
I can give you a 3 or 4 sentence, or I can give you 2 hours.
Make it 2 hours.
Ah, there we go. Are you taking this now? Yeah, okay. That's good. No. What's behind your question? What's the practice experience?
Again, from my own experience, is that compassion has continued to grow as I've been involved more and more in practice, and that the insight that develops from the practice reveals the relationship to all sentient beings. Now, maybe that I am using or hearing the word insight incorrect.
Compassion is the ability to be present with suffering. It's necessary if you're actually going to help somebody. If you can't be present with the suffering, then you will try to change the situation so that you don't feel the suffering. That's not helping the person. So the number one requisite in compassion is to be able to be present with the pain in the situation. To do that, you have to let go of control. which for some people is a bit challenging. I have one student who's a self-admitted control freak. We've been working on his driving. He keeps trying to arrange the cars on the freeway. Insight is the ability to see into what is happening. So they're quite different. No feeling implied. An insight, not necessarily. You just see into what is. So it has a penetrating quality. Just don't spoil my story. Now, when we use the term insight in Buddhism, we mean we are pointing to something that's quite different from the way the word is used in ordinary English. And even within Buddhism, there are significant distinctions in how the word is used. In the Theravadan tradition, the word mindfulness refers to what in the Mahayana tradition we refer to as the union of shamatha and vipassana. It's quite different usage. Even within the Mahayana, in the Gelugpa tradition, insight is used to refer to working with such questions as what is the nature of mind? What is the color of your mind? Where is your mind? All of that kind of stuff. You know what I'm talking about. In the Kadri tradition, those questions are viewed as the preparation for insight. And insight actually refers to seeing into mind nature. That's insight. Okay, which you and I were working with this morning. Now, it's quite possible to be able to stand and be present in the presence of pain and suffering and have no insight. And it's quite possible to see into the nature of mind and have difficulty being present with suffering. It's possible. And unfortunately, that happens. In the Mahayana tradition, emptiness, which is the result of seeing, and compassion are regarded as, well, the phrase that my teacher, Rinpoche, Kala Rinpoche, always used was Tong Ni Ning Je Ning Po Chen. Tong Ni is the Tibetan word for emptiness, and Ning Je is the word for compassion. Ning Po is the word for heart. And Chen is the word to have. To have the heart, or the essence, which is the union of compassion and emptiness. And this is, I think, one of the aspects of the genius of the Mahayana, is the recognition that you need both. In terms of practice, as you cultivate compassion, that is, you become more and more able to be in the presence of suffering, then you can open to more and more experience. You can open to the experience of everyone you encounter. You can open to the totality of your experience, because you can be present with the pain in others, and you can be present with the pain in you. So you open to the totality of your experience. And this provides you with a stability of attention which is awfully useful when it comes to developing insight. At the same time, when you really see into how things work, and we're talking about mind, but it's the same, in other areas of knowledge, compassion arises quite naturally, unless there's an emotional block against it. So, for instance, if you have mastered a body of knowledge, you know, carpentry, psychotherapy, linguistics, it doesn't matter. But you really know it, you understand it very deeply. What do you experience when you see someone fumbling around and making mistakes in the area of knowledge that you know so well? Yeah, you feel compassion. So that's why I say compassion is a natural, arises naturally from deep knowing, unless there is an emotional block. And there are all kinds of people who have very deep knowledge of a particular area and aren't particularly noted for their compassion. So, yes, the two work with each other and can and do enhance each other. But it's not a given. It's not a given. And that's why one is encouraged to cultivate both. Okay? Right. Newcomb.
I found yesterday when I was contemplating the karma involved with situations where I had caused harm, that it seemed that their insight and compassion arose very much together. Mm-hmm. As I sort of explored the whole chain of what had happened, I became acutely aware of the pain and suffering that I caused, and at the same time aware of all the things that I caused.
That's right, yeah. You see, in our practice, when we sit and we get distracted and we come back and then we get to deal with our emotional blocks and we work through those in some way, what we're developing in the course of all this is an intimate knowledge, an intimate understanding of the process of suffering in us. But the process of suffering in us is exactly the same as the process of suffering in every other person. The content, the fixations, they may be different, but the process is exactly the same. And the more deeply we know that in ourselves, the more deeply we understand it in others, and then, as you say, understanding and compassion arise quite naturally. But it comes from knowing ourselves deeply. In connection with this, did I talk about the four horses?
No.
One of the early scriptures, there's reference to the four horses. Now, the first horse gallops as fast as the wind at the rider's urging. The second horse gallops just as well as the first horse when he sees the whip in the rider's hands or hand. The third horse gallops when he feels the whip contact his skin. And the fourth horse doesn't gallop until he feels the pain of the whip in the marrow of his bones. Which horse do you want to be? Now, when we hear this story, as Suzuki Roshi says, most of us want to be the best horse. How much does the best horse understand suffering? From the point of view of our practice, you may find the fourth horse is the best horse. I've noticed people who are able to sit easily have a difficult time really understanding. People who have more trouble sitting or more trouble with their practice, they usually end up knowing something. So think about it. It's really about knowing your own experience intimately, directly, completely. And when you know that, you know everything that's really important. Because then you know what is happening in another person because you know it in yourself. And you know how to be present with it because you've learned how to be present with it in yourself. So there's your insight and compassion. Okay? Yes?
I feel relieved now that we're towards joy. It's been a very, very rough day. To me, part of what you said about going to lunch, I felt like I was in a minefield. You know? It's like, I don't want to talk. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to do anything. We're joking here. Who would be the first one to talk?
I didn't say don't talk.
It turned out it wasn't a problem. but the phenomenon I was having, one of them that I can identify this morning, was I felt as though choosing the malevolence and the whatever and going at it from that way was more difficult for me because what kept coming into my mind were things that I'm already experiencing a lot of pain from today. And wanting to maybe work with those. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure quite how to do that.
Okay. That first day was just to get us into things and show you a way of working with that traditional material, which could be very fruitful, but also to help you identify reactive patterns that are operating in you. If you're able to identify those, then work with those. And just go through the process that I was describing this morning, where you know a situation or a genre of situations in which you fall into reaction. Okay, then walk through it very slowly, noting what you're experiencing at each moment. So you actually begin to experience the reaction in you. And as you do this, and you may have to do this several times, you'll begin to get a sense of the discomfort or which you're avoiding or seeking to avoid by falling into reaction or which the reactive mechanism is getting you away from. And now you start bringing attention to that. Okay? And you can, our practice here is unearth some things and giving you fuel for your practice, then start burning the fuel. Okay? Well, we're going to do something a little lively right now.
But we're not going to do something lively, is there something?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's the one breath meditation. Yeah, that's all you get. Now, the one breath meditation looks like this. You know, you're really sleepy, or really tired, or you're really distracted, or you're really sleepy, tired, and distracted. You know. Okay. So, you do one breath. Not so bad, was it? Can you do one breath? Just one breath. Yeah, just breathe out and be so that, no, not forcefully, just quite naturally, so that by the end of that breath, you're fully awake and present. Can you do that? Well, try it. Just one breath. And with that one breath, you're going to cut through all of the tiredness, confusion, distraction, sluggishness, torpidity, toxic narcolepsy. Okay, it's just one breath. It wasn't so bad, was it? Okay. Then you stop. One breath meditation. Then you do it again. Well, you breathe in naturally. You finish your meditation, you relax. Okay? And then, when you're ready, you do it again. You do that for 15, 20, 30 times, just one breath at a time. Maybe by then you have enough confidence to try two breath meditation. Okay? Now, this is just an extreme application of a well-known meditation instruction. Short sessions, many of them. Well, the session has now been shortened to one breath. But it works very well. Just one breath. And then you relax. And maybe you just fall asleep. But no, you're not. That's fine. Okay. Because you're tired. And then one breath. But you're totally clear. One student approached Munindra. He said, I keep falling asleep when I meditate. Said, okay. Well, what do I do about this? What's the problem? Well, I keep falling asleep when I meditate. Yeah, yes, I heard you. What's the problem? I keep falling asleep when I meditate. Yes, I understand that. What is the problem? And the student went, and then Munindra said, now, before you fall asleep, which nostril is there more air going out? I don't know. Ah, now I understand your problem. The point is to be right in your experience. Okay? Well, yeah, but you're right there. Okay? That's all we can do. Okay. What I want to do is to avoid toxic narcolepsy and other deadly diseases. We're going to do an exercise. It's a paired exercise. Paul, this goes to your point about how do we deal with people who aren't as enlightened as we are. Or at least who aren't practicing the way we are. We can't. Okay. Which, you know, one of the things I do in my spare time is a certain amount of business consulting and executive coaching. And these are people who, they don't have any practice, and most of them aren't interested in any practice, and They don't have any time for highfalutin ideas like attention and mindfulness. And I'm not even worrying about things like emptiness and compassion. We don't. Just how to be sane. You know, just how to lead their departments. And how not to alienate everybody in their office. And, you know, just straightforward, usual corporate stuff. I'm not getting into that one. So, you're going to divide up into pairs. And one of you, and this is going to rotate, of course, so everybody will get a turn. But I want the rules to be really clear. One of you is going to explain to the other how to change a light bulb. I found that this is the most useful one. Pardon? You're going to explain how to change a light bulb. Is there anybody here who doesn't know how? Okay. No, just the screw. Now, the other person, within a sentence or two of the explanation, simply says, and these are the only words you're allowed to say, "I don't understand." Whether you do or not, you are to say this. "I don't understand." That's the only words you're allowed to say for this exercise. At which point, the person who is explaining how to change the light bulb, you've got to start over again. And the second person, when they reach the same point in the explanation, even if they went another route, you say, all together now, "I don't understand." Yes, okay. You do this 5 times. And we'll have a little discussion afterwards.
You just interrupt the explanation or wait until...
No. No, within the first, within a sentence or two, because we don't want to take a long time on this. You say, "I don't understand." I want one person to do, you're going to be the explainer, and this person is going to interrupt you 5 times. And then after that, we're going to switch roles. Okay. All right? It can't be the same pair, we'll see. All right? But this is, are anybody unclear about... Well,
do you get to ask the other person questions about...
Sure. Do you know what a light bulb is? "I don't understand." The only thing the other person is going to say is, "I don't understand." Okay? So, pair up, preferably with someone you don't know. And husband and wife should not do this exercise together. One more point. Could I have your attention, please? Okay. When the person says, "I don't understand," both of you take a breath and experience what you're experiencing right there. Right from the beginning.
Okay.
Okay, how many have completed five on one side? Okay. Finish up quickly and then reverse. And so you do five on the other side. Okay, everybody done five in both directions? Okay, just take a minute and finish up then. I don't understand. Okay, let's come back together. Now, okay. When you were the explainer, what did you experience at the first interruption?
Surprise.
Surprise? Irritation.
Irritation? A little curiosity, like, huh?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Challenge, okay. Curiosity. So, okay, that's another thing. Okay. Yes? Yeah, I don't understand. Okay, what did you experience at the second interruption? Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
Lack of control.
Yeah, I got that. What else? Frustration? Weariness? Okay. Pardon? Yes, you started to. Okay. Anybody experience incredulity?
Yes.
Like, huh? But I was so clear. I may not have been clear the first time, but I know I was clear this time. Right?
All different. All of that going in a light bulb.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other side. Now, after the third interruption, what did you experience?
What was that?
What was that? Contempt?
No, I contemplate.
Right. Anger? Stun?
Frustration?
Anybody?
Pity.
Tedium? Pity? Okay. Okay. Ill will, right? Yeah.
That was like, okay, I will screw in the light bulb.
Right.
The hell with it, right?
Futility.
Well, no, just taking over the situation.
Yeah, okay. The futility of trying to explain it. Okay. And the fifth?
I give up.
Right. Okay. Now, question. How many times have you experienced this dynamic in your lives?
Out of the verbal and say, come over, let me show
yeah.
you how to
do it. It wouldn't have made any difference. They would have said, I don't understand.
I don't understand, but I'm showing her how
yeah.
to screw in the light bulb and taking care of it at the same time. If she doesn't understand, that's her problem.
Okay. Just another approach. Okay. Now, when you were the interrupter, what did you experience on the first interruption? Okay. Anybody else?
Power.
Power. Anybody else?
Fear.
Come up.
Control.
Yeah. Fear. Who said that? What were you afraid of?
Afraid that I wasn't getting what they were saying. That it was my responsibility that I wasn't getting.
Okay.
Self-satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
Embarrassment.
Okay. On the second repetition, a second interruption. No, that's the first. Okay. Okay. What were you sad about?
It's a little bit like the sensation of somebody who doesn't know how to read, and someone's really telling them something. And I just had that flash of like, shit, this must be a really awful thing.
Okay.
Because I don't get what she's saying. Even though I know all the time telling.
Okay. You felt what? You humor? Yeah. Third interruption.
I saw a woman to help.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Patience? You felt, kept saying, I don't understand.
Antagonism.
Boredom.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
Compassion.
Mm-hmm.
If I resist the right woman,
Yes, there we are. Sadism. There you are. Trying to minimize the pain. Yeah. Okay. Fourth, fifth, what do you experience? Yeah. Okay. Right. Now, this is a totally set up exercise. Everybody knew everything that was going on. Right? Yet all of these feelings came up. All of these stories. How many of you, when you were explaining, felt at some point, this person must be incredibly stupid?
Yeah.
That come up? Okay.
What did he
know? No. But it comes up anyway. Right? And how many of you felt despair? I'm never going to get through. Right? Yeah. Okay. And on the other side, aha, I have the power. Right. Okay. You didn't feel that? A lot of people did. Maybe not you. And, oh, this poor person. Okay. Okay. But the thing is that you, when you feel, oh, the poor person, you're not really acknowledging who the perpetrator is here. It's you. That's why they're suffering. And so it's a beautiful way of exiting from your role in the situation. Exactly. Now, the reason for this exercise is that everything you experience here is a reaction. Everything you experienced is a reaction. They are feelings and thoughts and ways of the looking at the world which were provoked by the resonance of this situation with past experience. And even though it's a totally set up situation, we all fall into it. That's how reactive patterns operate. We fall out of awareness and it just runs. So there's one person, you know, totally into it, looking for just the precise place to be maximally frustrating to the individual. And there's another person thinking, how can I minimize the pain here? I'm really uncomfortable with it. Okay. And I imagine that's what you're doing in other situations in your lives, right? So, that's a reactive pattern. Now, reviewing your experience in either situation, you can take your choice, either as the explainer or the interrupter. What experience were you trying to avoid? The experience of conflict, okay. Josephine? Experience of feeling helpless? Anybody else? Mm-hmm. But anger is usually a reaction to another feeling. So you get angry to avoid something else. What's under... let's go a little deeper.
Fear.
Fear for some people? Mm-hmm. Yes? Mm-hmm. Anybody else? What? Okay. 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 So you wanted to avoid the feeling of surrender. Okay. What feeling were you, if you weren't focusing on how to interrupt at precisely the right point?
Well, I guess my, the thing that stood out to me was maybe would be that to a certain extent maybe avoiding taking the exercise completely seriously.
Okay.
Because of, like if I were in a real situation, I wouldn't try to frustrate a person in a real situation because it's a game.
Ah, you see? This is a person who grew up in a family where games were played for blood. That's where it's permissible to play for blood. Yeah. Yeah, you're allowed to do anything. I had a great uncle. He was wonderful. He was he's a Scottish Presbyterian. He was a brilliant scientist. And he was utterly moral. Except when he played games. And, you know, so you play something like Scrabble, and you put down a word, and everybody said, that's not a word. And he said, of course it's a word. What do you mean? And you had to be prepared to challenge him and lose your turn. And he figured if he could get away with it, that was perfectly fair in the context of a game. So that's another whole thing that's going on there. It also gives you permission to do a lot of other things. Yeah.
For me, there was a kind of sadness to that.
Yes.
Because it was a kind of to engage. You know, what I was saying in the end became less important than the fact that I went in contact with
it. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it's designed to miss you, miss each other in a big way, right? Yeah. Right. So you get the feeling of how reactive patterns take you away from something you don't want to experience. That's their function. And they project a whole world, a whole realm. Like you look at this person in a certain way. How many of you, when you were in the interrupter seat, felt that this person was your plaything? Yes. Yeah? Right? God realm. Okay? And there you are. You're not going to give up. Titan realm.
If it was real, what would have been that? If it had been real life, you would have felt, and if it wasn't a set of situation, you really didn't understand.
Yeah. Exactly, that's what one person said. Okay? So, all of these, and when you're at inadequacy, that's usually coming out of the Titan realm. That's why you compete so much, or out of the Hungry Ghost realm, which is why you're so greedy, because you're trying to fill something up. Yes?
I don't understand how you can tell the difference between the experience you're trying to avoid and the pattern. I mean, inadequacy, is that an experience you're trying to avoid, or is that a pattern?
Well, both. The feeling of inadequacy can be a feeling that you try to avoid, and you go into a reactive behavior, like you get super competitive, so that you don't have to feel that inadequacy. But as you say, it's also a pattern, and this is what I refer to as patterns being layered. So you peel away the competitiveness, you get the inadequacy. You peel away the inadequacy, you might get something like a feeling of shame about yourself. And you just keep peeling away until you get back to a basic feeling, which when you can experience in attention, and you experience it so that you know it is simply a feeling, then the whole house of cards collapses. And you don't have to react that way in that situation anymore. You take the guts out of the pattern engine. Right. Paul?
It seems to me that if you were to break the group in two groups separately and give them both separate instructions and then do this one time, it would be more realistic in terms of our ongoing relationship with others.
Yes.
And might open up.
You're quite right, but because I'm using this for illustrative purposes, I don't want anybody walking away feeling that they have been abused, etc. So I've chosen, when I do this, is to make sure everybody knows that it's a totally set up situation, And there's another advantage to that, because everybody knows exactly what's going to happen, and the reactions arise anyway. And that's a characteristic of reactive patterns, is that they aren't about the situation. They're inappropriate response to the situation. They're dictated by what has resonated inside. So when everybody knows what's going on, they say, yeah, you're right, I was feeling that, and there was no reason to, but you're feeling it anyway. Okay? But yes, if you split it up like that and say, okay, this is what you're going to do, this is what you're going to do, then there could be occasion for some pretty deep stuff to come up. Yeah. Yes? Oh, it's very fast. Yeah, it's very fast.
You know, wanting to kill the person.
Yep. Yeah.
But it's all can all be between
the... Well, it isn't necessarily played out.
Okay.
But in many cases it is. I mean, you look at people in the business world. You know, after you've earned your first $50 million, how much more money do you need to live? No, 150. Yeah. And what these people are trying to do is satisfy something by just being the top, being the best, etc. I mean, you talk to top business people and they say, oh, it's not the money, it's the score. Mm-hmm. That's just the way you keep score. Yeah. And, you know, unfortunately, what they're doing with their money in order to get a better score than the other guys, wreaking havoc in the society. But no, what's important to them is getting the highest score. That's it. So. Okay. Let's take a break and then we'll return for meditation.
Don't
no, this part we don't need to take. No.
That insider compassion.
only an intellectual would ask such a question. Now, what I'm trying to do here is give you enough experiential flavor for your meditation practice. This morning, I asked you to start going through a reactive pattern and feeling all of the different sensations in body, emotions, and cognitive mind. And so, by going through that kind of detailed tracking, bringing attention to your experience, you can start to notice when you move out of responding to a situation to reacting. And that's the crucial distinction in Buddhism, the difference between response and reaction. When we react, we're just running a tape. Now, in many work situations, and this certainly I've observed in the corporate world, you're hired and you're promoted because the way you react serves the interests of the corporation. The consequence of that is that you move more and more into reaction throughout your career, and you end up profoundly alienated from yourself unless you take remedial steps. But that's what actually happens. You're paid to react certain ways. Yes? Also, yes, and the education system, things like that. So there's huge bodies of reaction. Our small task in Buddhism? Undo it all. Pardon? Well, as I said to somebody the other day, if you are not reacting, you're actually responding. In 3% of your life, you're doing very well. If you're doing 5%, you're probably going to be regarded as an awake individual. If you're doing 7%, you're qualifying for sainthood. No, a lot of the stuff we do habitually, and it serves. But is it possible to wake up and be present? Yeah, totally. It is possible. Is it easy? Depends on your perspective. On the one hand, there's nothing to it. On the other hand, you have to let go of everything you know. Yes?
I've been harboring this fantasy that if I had started in my 20s, I'm now in my 50s, if I had been able to go to some school or drama, that I would be far, far better off than this human little self that's 58 today, starting the path.
Mm-hmm.
Can you help me with
that
in any way? Because I know it's part of it.
Well, yes. And the question that I have found, which one question I found really useful for getting at what's driving a reactive pattern is, if I wasn't acting or thinking or doing this, what would I have to feel? So if you didn't harbor or hold that idea, what would you have to feel?
Hopeless.
Right, that's where you start. Now, hopelessness is a very powerful feeling. However, I have it on good authority that it is a feeling, not a fact. No? Okay, last comment, quickly.
How do these practices that you are teaching this weekend interact with the sort of Dzogchen Mahamudra cutting through?
How do they interact with Mahamudra and Dzogchen?
I mean, that sort of thing, the cutting through, cutting off every branch from the root.
Well, Mahamudra and Dzogchen aren't about cutting through at all.
Well,
that's a misconception there. And how they interact?
Well, I'm sorry, I didn't say Mahamudra, but we're about cutting through. I didn't say Mahamudra. Is that one of the practices that we're given?
Yeah. Oh, I know it's called Trekcha and all that, but it's not what you do at all. The interaction is this. To do those practices, you have to have a sufficient capacity in attention that you are able and willing to experience whatever arises. Whatever arises. Now, as I said before, I had the privilege and doing a 3-week Dzogchen retreat last fall. Our meditation instruction was very elaborate, very complicated, consisted of one sentence: do nothing. For 3 weeks. that's exactly right. Do nothing. We had a interview every other day. Do nothing.
Not once
a day. No, do nothing. That was a great relief.
Was it do nothing or lack of nothing?
Do nothing. Okay?
Did you survive it?
That's for you to judge. Now, it took a few days to settle down, etc. It was great. And it had a significant
I felt there was a significant shift in my practice. I got a lot out of the retreat. Very glad to have done it. But on the 12th, around the 17th or 18th day or so, somewhere around there, I was sitting on the balcony of my cabin, doing nothing. I was quite happy doing nothing. And then I thought of Longchenpa. And I thought of Kala Rinpoche. And I thought of many other teachers. These guys were prepared to do nothing for 12 years. Now, how many of you harbor any personal ambitions? What would it be like to do nothing to fulfill any of those personal ambitions, hopes, dreams, ideas, etc., for 12 years? Nothing. 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 Yeah, they cooked, they did that, but they just sit and do nothing. And my faith and appreciation of what these guys did, just like, wow. That's really something. And these people were willing to experience whatever arose. All of the disappointments, all of the hopes, all of the dreams. How long can any of you sit with that stuff? That's what I mean about a capacity of attention in which you are able and willing to experience whatever arises. So these are not easy practices. It's one thing to do nothing for an afternoon. Actually, it's not hard to do it for 3 weeks, though I think it would drive some people nuts. 1, 6, 12 years, as Longchenpa did. Totally different ball game. Okay, now I want to go into meditation instructions. We've got to do some this afternoon, just to keep up for form's sake. I also have a few more people to see in interviews. So I want you to go through practice, through situations where reactions come up, and feel where the reaction arises. And you'll notice that by all of the sensations that arise in your body and emotions and things like that. If you suddenly get lost in thinking, it's a very good indication you've hit reactive material, because everybody uses the intellect to get away from feeling. If you go to sleep, it's also a good indication you're hitting reactive material, because that's a great way of checking out and don't have to feel anything.
Even you've forgotten what you were reacting
to. Well, you got to go back and do it again. And the thing, the way practice works here, it's exactly the way, same way that shamatha works. You sit down in shamatha, you breathe, get lost in the thought. After a while you go, oh yeah, that's right, I got lost in the thought. And you come back and you breathe again, breathe, get lost in another thought. Oh, yeah. But as you do this over a period of time, you begin to move back until a time comes when you're sitting there resting with the breath and the thought comes up and you realize, oh, there's a thought. But you don't get lost. You're just, oh. And it goes up and goes poof and you go, whew. And you're just there the whole time. And you go, and that's actually developing a capacity of attention so you can experience a little reactive process, because the thought is a little reactive process. So we're doing this on a larger scale now. So you just keep coming back, keep going through the same situation. You're going to get lost, confused, and all kinds of uncomfortable feelings come up, etc., etc. You keep going through it. And this way, gradually, you're going to hit whatever that reactive process is based on, which is some kind of uncomfortable feeling. If you hit that, and you may or may not. Some people in the interviews hit it, and some didn't. But if you hit it, now just rest in that feeling. Because at this point, you don't know that it is a feeling. It feels like a fact to you. That's why you run away from it. That's why you do the reactive patterns kick up, just to get away from it. So now you need to develop your capacity of attention just to experience it, just to rest in the experience of it. That may take, you know, anywhere from 5 minutes to 10 years. And until you know, and I don't mean intellectually, I mean experientially, you know it to be a feeling. Then everything changes. So that's the big scheme of the practice. Okay? So we'll start. And I think we'll just do the same thing we did two periods, which we'll take with one period of Qigong. Okay. Where did we finish with the interviews? You're next. So then you and Didier and Scott, is it? Okay.
Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you do wish to use a part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.